As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. This is a great interview because Mona Mahajan has one of the great double major undergraduate degrees in the combine of North American education out of Wharton in economics and computer science as well. And Mona, that means you know that there's a zero and one in computer language. Did we get enough of a zero and one decision tree off of Friday's Mexico discussion, off of the various central bankers' discussions that you need on a zero and one basis shift aggressively the Allianz strategy?
Hi, Tom. Hi, John. Happy Monday. And yes, the Friday news was certainly an interesting one. In some ways, we actually felt that tariffs perhaps worked with Mexico. Interestingly, you know, when you compare Mexico to China, United States is a much larger trading partner with Mexico, accounts for nearly, 80% of Mexican exports, about 30% of GDP. The U.S. for China is only about 19% of exports, 4% of GDP, call it. So, really clearly a more clear incentive for Mexico to act in the face of tariffs.
Does it change your strategy? I want to know, on an equity market or bond market basis, did you have to adjust off that information?
So we are still very much concerned about the second half of the year when the Chinese tariffs perhaps escalate to a full 25% on $525 billion of imports. We think that could create some downside pressure on the economy, on the consumer in particular. And so until we get some direction on that, we remain defensive, a little bit more conservative, I would say. So no, not a real change, although we do expect some, risk on, as you talked about, some perhaps a bounce given a positive, some positive progress with Mexico.
Mona, there seems to be some confidence here that the Fed can engineer a soft landing. We're kind of back to that story, aren't we? Before, maybe a couple of weeks back, this tug of war between viewing low rates as a buffer to risk assets versus viewing low rates as signaling something bad. The latter was winning out. Then last week, it feels like the former is winning again. Mona, do you think the Fed can engineer what is called a soft landing?
Well, it's interesting. We maybe have a slightly different perspective. I do think last week we did see a nice bounce off, 5 to 7% correction in the S&P. But earlier on in the year when markets were calling for a Fed rate cut, we didn't see the case for that as much. The idea of an insurance cut, the idea that perhaps they'll cut to stimulate inflation, to us didn't quite make sense, didn't quite meet their mandates. Now, as we're talking about the pressures building on the second half of the year, perhaps downsides to the global economy, the idea of a rate cut is making more and more sense to us. I think, if the Fed does see the whites of the eyes of a downturn or recession, they will be forced to act. And so, as the market starts pricing in more and more rate cuts, we don't know if three makes sense, but perhaps one or two by year end actually does start to make sense. But we'd like to see some real data deterioration and perhaps beyond what we've seen already.
World's coming to an end, except I got a VIX at 16.07 with futures printing Dow 26,000. What do I do with cash that I must deploy to equities? Do I sit on it or am I enthused to acquire shares this morning?
Yeah, we still remain defensive across equities and fixed income, but what we talk about still in equities is the barbell approach. And, what we like on one hand of that barbell continues to be those parts of technology that perhaps are not as, exposed to China, but areas like mobile payments, cloud computing, perhaps cybersecurity, which should be enhanced going forward. The other hand of that barbell continues to be the more defensive area. So we like the staples and the healthcare, which have lagged this year, which can do well in a decelerating growth environment. The cloud around healthcare, I think, has lifted a little bit. And so valuations actually look okay there.
So in the risk-on part of the barbell, Mona, you're looking for the secular growth stories. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so those are the secular growth stories that really, you know, for long-term investors with a 3 to 5 year horizon, these are areas of technology that are now less cyclical. So tech has historically been, you know, up and down, but, you know, areas like a mobile payments or even cybersecurity or parts of the cloud are interesting to us because, you know, they can just continue to grow, expand their share, and perhaps are in the second growth mode.
Mona, thank you so much. Mona Manahajan joins us this morning from Allianz on the equity markets. Mark Chandler, Bannockburn, with us, who for years has said, avoid the blended indexes, trade weighted, and look at the pairs. Is renminbi got a vector finally through Goldman Sachs, rather, over the weekend?
Well, here,
you know, a tinge of that?
Yeah, here's what I did. I looked at a page that you have on Bloomberg, FXFM.
Yeah, you like that.
And what it shows you is, based on current volatility, you have a band around current spot, given the volatility, within 3 months, the odds are that we're going to break that 700 level. That is, that's to say that 700 is sort of the meat part of a bell-shaped curve. And so I think it's not such a big call. I think that what's more interesting to me is, to your point, John, about how much the Chinese are concerned about it, how much they're going to defend it. And we're not going to know it until we get a little bit closer to it. You know, I think that today was a bit of a catch-up move because China was closed on Friday. And so they did take the CNH, the offshore, maybe lower. And so the onshore just sort of played a little bit of catch-up with it. I want to give it a couple more days to see what the Chinese are really going to do here.
So the choice, the decision mix is essentially, from a Chinese policymaker standpoint, do you constrain, do you tolerate, or do you engineer? There were some people worried about them engineering currency weakness. No sign of that whatsoever. Some people thought they might constrain it. Little sign of that too. It looks like maybe, Mark, they actually just tolerate the weakness. They just let it happen.
Sure, I think that there's a good case that can be for that. I mean, you see even yesterday or earlier today when the Asian equity markets all moved higher, China really struggled. And I think maybe even the Shanghai might have been even the underperformer in the whole region last night. And so I think people are a bit reluctant because they're afraid of this vicious cycle. Currency weakens, so we sell off the stocks. Stocks weaken, so we sell off the currency again. And it's not clear how they break that.
I love the way you framed FXFM with dollar renminbi. I just looked at the volatility surface, folks, which doesn't play on TV or radio. It's wicked complicated. But, you know, it's truly, Mark, a one-way bet on renminbi or yuan weakness. Anytime I say one-way bet, all my radar goes up. Is the street wrong on this? I mean, can there be a case for currency stability?
Well, I think that's what China really wants in the big picture thing. So I think that a weaker RMB, what it does is it really shifts, it really deters China from doing the kind of reforms it wants to do to move up the value-added chain. So I think that China has it in their interest to avoid a vicious cycle and a sharply weaker currency, to your point about engineering it. But tolerating a little bit of weakness probably doesn't hurt that much, especially given that's the direction of policy in general, right? Economy a bit weaker. You expect some stimulus. The PBOC governor said they have plenty of stimulus.
Yeah.
And so I think that's just perfectly consistent with it.
So let's talk about the effectiveness of the stimulus from the Chinese so far. Expected policy drives markets because it shapes forecasts of future outcomes. The future outcome that stimulus from the Chinese is shaping is essentially that the rest of the world could well stabilize. That was the belief going into the second half of this year. Looking at the trade data from China, Mark, what can we read into the effectiveness of that stimulus so far when the import data is still so weak?
Yeah, it's hard for me to read this because I see a lot of this is being gamed. Right?
Interesting.
Two things happening, I think. One is that a lot of businesses in the U.S. may be importing a lot more stuff from China to build up inventories before tariffs go into effect. I can see China doing similar things on their end. But I also think there is a weakness in the Chinese economy, and we see this through the commodity through the commodity imports. You know, they've had a huge African swine problem, have to cull their herd. And so what happens is soybean imports plunged. You've got oil imports fell as well. And this is what you'd expect to see from a weakening economy or an economy that's got some shock. So I think that it's funny, you know, most people disbelieve a lot of Chinese data unless it's weak. and then we believe it.
That's where the investor bias is right now. Really interesting story coming out of Vietnam, Tom. You might be interested in this. Some Chinese exporters going to extreme lengths to avoid the tariffs from the United States. Vietnam saying over the weekend that it found dozens of fake product origin certificates and illegal transfers by companies trying to sidestep U.S. tariffs on everything from agriculture to textiles to steel. This showing up in Vietnam. And if you look at the Vietnam trade data, we have seen a huge boom, Mark, coming from Vietnam into the United States.
Yeah, this is a remarkable thing. You know, early in my career when Reagan was a president, Japan was the Asian power we were afraid of. They accounted for about 40% of U.S. imports. So now 35 years later or something like that, and now China accounts for about 40-45% of U.S. imports. And what we're going to do is block Chinese imports into the U.S., and they're just going to go someplace else. And Vietnam is probably the point of sort of the point that everybody's focused on right now. And by the way, the Treasury Department has increased its surveillance of countries under the currency, under its currency watch.
You wonder if they're looking at Vietnam.
Vietnam was what they Vietnam is part of that now.
Let's talk about what it means for markets. You've got two calls, weaker dollar, higher equities. They're not connected as far as I'm aware, Mark. So walk me through the two separate calls.
Yeah, so sure. So on the dollar, you know, I was, Bloomberg published a book of mine back in 2009, and I talked about a secular bull market for the dollar. And now I'm concerned that that secular bull market for the dollar is over. I can tell you quick three little factoids for you. One is the policy mix has changed from tight monetary, loose fiscal, which is very positive for a currency, to its exact opposite. Secondly, interest rate differentials have been a leg for the dollar. They've been moving against the U.S. for 6 months, say, against Europe. That is, and the third thing is that another good page I use on Bloomberg, WCRS, I look at the purchasing power parity using the OECD's model. The euro is the most undervalued currency, around 23% undervalued. So I combine these things, changing policy mix in the U.S., narrowing interest rate differentials, and an overvalued dollar, undervalued euro. And that's what gives me my sense that the dollar is going to pull back.
So what about on the equity markets?
Equity market, I'm bullish. I think that essentially what we saw is that that May decline was a three-leg decline, hit a retracement target almost to the tick, and coming back here, I think there's no place else for investors to put their money. Bonds at low yields. We've got something like $11 trillion of negative yielding bonds now in the world. So
more than that, I think, Mark.
Yeah, where can you get the money? So I think it just forces us more and more into the equity market, for good or for bad. It drives us into the
equities. So let me put you on the spot, because Mark Dow out on Twitter asked this question. I think it's a great mental exercise for everyone just to get together and ask themselves this question. The next 10% move in equities, higher or lower? You think higher?
My guess is higher.
Mark Chandler, great to catch up with you. Bannockburn
Mark, thank
Global.
You so much.
Thank you.
Really,
Chief
really
Market
good.
Strategist joining us here at Bloomberg in New York. Big week ahead again, Tom. CPI, PPI coming up Tuesday,
and retail
Wednesday.
Sales.
Retail sales coming up on Friday. We'll hear from President Draghi, I think, Wednesday as well. So some ECB speakers.
What can he say after
Well,
the
over
press
the weekend,
conference?
There was a report from Reuters over the weekend that officials, some of the officials they'd spoken to, ready to cut rates if the data gets worse. I have no idea where ECB monetary policy goes, given where it is right now.
Okay, but Mark Chandler, very quickly here, because of time, it's just a race to the bottom. I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it seems like what the central banks want to do is tell the world that they can do more if needed. The question is, will more be needed? Will more really be
so
needed?
So what is this QE? I've lost count. What's Larian got? QE6? I mean, seriously. Haven't we all been here before?
Well, what do they buy next? I mean, to Mark's point, you've already got around $12 trillion of negative yielding assets worldwide. Where do they go next? They buy corporates, they've bought sovereigns, do they buy equities?
You guys,
and if they go to an SMB-style depot rate, do they bring in a tiered rate?
You guys are doing all this fancy currency stuff.
What are you up to over there?
Should I move to Connecticut?
Why'd you want to move to Connecticut?
That's where I went for this wedding.
Oh, did you like
there's
it
like
up there?
There's like lawns. I just want to go.
I thought people were leaving Connecticut.
I think so. I got to go back to get lonely up there.
I thought everyone was heading to Florida.
No, they're leaving Connecticut, seriously, because of a lot of tax.
Selling the Connecticut dollar.
I want to buy a California trimmer, high cut 20-inch, 5-blade
what
Honda
is that?
GX. It's a lawnmower.
It's a lawnmower.
You go mow lawn.
I could see you out there mowing
lawn. Have you ever mowed a lawn?
Yeah.
Seriously, when did you last mow a lawn?
My father was the last person on the block to have a power mower. I was
pushing. When did you last mow a lawn?
Oh,
we got like 50
Nick,
years ago.
Nixon was president.
Mark Chandler, great to catch up with you.
Can you see me in Connecticut?
I can see you in Connecticut. I can't see you mowing a lawn.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
This is a joy. We're going to talk to someone knee-deep in the modern politics. Of course, many of our listeners are going to go, yo, that's great, but it's still, you got to get in the voting booth and vote. But there's a certain way to brand, to get message out, et cetera. Ben LeBolt was, you know, to call it a young advisor to Mr. Obama, where he would say, Senator, and he'd raise his hand up and say, excuse me, sir, because he was that young. Now he's ancient. He's like really moved on to the ancient level. And Ben LeBolt joins us here on the new politics and how President Trump is taking best practices from President Obama, written up with great acclaim over the weekend in The Atlantic magazine. Ben LeBolt joins us this morning. Ben, good morning.
Be with you. Wow, you aged me quickly.
I aged you quickly. Let's. What I find fascinating is you came out of Middlebury College, where you were like the head of the college Democrats or whatever. Are there any Republicans at Middlebury College?
Well, when I was there, I would say the student body was maybe 20 to 25% Republican,
yeah,
conservative. So they actually taught me how to be a better debater. We had some very, very smart ones in my classes.
That's good to get that going. And of course, a lot of people would say the younger crew is less engaged today than it really should be. I want one more general question before we get to your wonderful Atlantic magazine article. What's the impact of Bernie Sanders do? I mean, it's the second time around for Mr. Sanders. He is aged, et cetera. Is there the same impact or the different impact with his loyal younger following?
Well, I think Senator Sanders changed the terms of the debate. He came forward with some very bold policy ideas, like free college, like Medicare for all, that I think have moved where the Democratic primary electorate is. I do think there are some candidates who've embraced aspects of his policies who have a better chance of winning the nomination and beating Donald Trump in the long run. So they've taken the best of Bernie, but I think have more realistic plans to win on election.
Yeah. The last sentence of your Atlantic idea, so important. If Democrats don't act now, the Trump campaign will define the general election on its own terms before we can even choose our nominee. He's the incumbent. He's supposed to do that, right?
Well, he's exploiting a contentious primary. Look, there's 23 Democrats competing on our side of the aisle. It's going to be a long and contentious primary because we've got very strong candidates. And what Donald Trump is doing is he's taking every day that started on January 1st of this year to talk to persuadable voters in battleground states and get his message out. My view is that we need to start filling that gap on the Democratic side of the aisle and not just focusing on the primary.
How do you define liberal progressive? I mean, we had George Will on age 78. It's my book of the year. It's a book, Ben, that everyone should read, progressive, liberals, conservatives, everybody to read to get the old theology brought forward to the new theology. But what's the Democrat Party theology, the Democratic Party theology that can win right now? Is it more to the center? Can they actually go more liberal?
Well, I think it's a broad opportunity agenda that no matter who you are and what means you're born with, there should still be a chance to get ahead in this country if you work hard. And with the Trump administration, I think we've seen self-dealing. I think we've seen a tax cut that rewarded corporations, but actually raised taxes on people in states, mm-hmm, where you had the state and local tax exemption. So the Democratic Party is a broad tent, and I think we want to go into this election not only attracting self-defined progressives, but attracting independents and even lapsed Republicans who
right,
don't see the Republican Party, don't associate with the Republican Party of today, though they have in the past.
Yeah. Ben LeBolt with us, folks. An important article, Atlantic Magazine. Whatever your politics, it really defines the dynamics of modern campaigning right now. What is the best practice from a Senator Obama or a President Obama term two that President Trump will utilize forward?
Well, what I think he's doing is taking the reelection playbook that he saw the Obama campaign implement. Now, when we started that campaign at the beginning of 2011, the New York Times gave President Obama a 17% chance of being reelected based on historic economic indicators. We realized early in that year that voters had forgotten how bad the financial crisis had been and the potential peril as President Obama entered office and we'd been hemorrhaging jobs at the end of the Bush administration. We reminded them of the big decisions he'd made to get us back on track, from the Recovery Act to making a bold decision to save the auto industry. But we had 2 years to implement that effort. There was a contentious primary on the Republican side of the aisle, and we spent those 2 years talking to our targeted voters in battleground states. That's exactly what the Trump campaign is doing today. They're doing it through advertising. They're doing it through trips that the president is taking to battleground markets. And Democrats are focused on fighting each other to win the nomination. I'd expect that of them during the primary, but it's giving President Trump a free year to get his message out.
And Ben Lebold, he's getting his message out right now, talking to Joe Kernan over at CNBC, which is to be expected. And the headlines across the Bloomberg are simple. He doesn't want to cut spending on defense. He says no deal with China would mean more tariffs. I mean, it's the usual discussion, if you will. Do the Democrats fight back on policy, as we've certainly seen? And let's suggest that candidate Warren is the policy wonk of them all. Or do they have to fight back or frame the process on emotion? I mean, do you go policy or do you go emotion to position yourself at the convention or after the convention?
I think it's a mix of policy and values. So certainly we can argue that the tax cuts that benefited corporations but not the average American was not good policy. We can lay out an education plan to make sure that in this 21st century economy, we're laying out a plan for the average American to have a good paying job 20 years from now, 30 years from now. But ultimately, elections are about values just as much as they are about policy. And I think when you see images of, you know, kids being locked up in cages at the border, that's not who we are. And I think that's it's also important that our candidates campaign on the values that they see as fundamental
okay,
to
but,
being
but
American.
You know, I was going to say that's it, but this is so important, Ben. Democrats have to address an American fear over immigration. Do they criticize a president or do they come up with their own policy of X thousands of people at the border? Which is the best way to go for them?
Well, I think there's a couple of approaches. First of all, I think almost every Democrat in the field is on the record in support of a comprehensive immigration plan that, yes, addresses border security, but also offers a path to citizenship. And they view that as fundamental to the American way. Secondly, I think we need to attack the notion that it's immigration that's affecting the jobs of the average worker in the middle of the country. You know, I think the trends have a lot more to do with our modern economy and globalization and automation. Yeah. And I think it's on us to roll out a plan to show how new economy jobs will be created in the middle of the country and how if you're not a software engineer, you still have a viable path to finding a good paying job in the future. I agree we should roll out more policy on that front.
Okay, Ben, we got to leave it there. Ben Lebold, thank you so much. An important article in the Atlantic Magazine, controversial article, got a lot of splash, as it should. He's former National Press Secretary for President Obama's reelection campaign. This is the interview of the day on the roll-up of the Pentagon's providers. Nicholas Hayman was around when the Wright brothers did the first government contract to the Pentagon, and we are thrilled and honored that he could join us this morning. Nick Hayman, I think we all know, good to have you on, Nick. I think we all know that UTX and Raytheon are ginormous, venerable. We've been told by six experts today there's little overlap. What is the why of this? Is it a revenue grab? Is it a synergy play? Or is there something else nefarious going on?
No, they've alluded to a little bit of, you know, opportunity from a revenue standpoint. But I think the real core of the why is simply you're now seeing a convergence of defense, you know, critical technologies that are going to be increasingly utilized across commercial aerospace. And whether that's cyber protection, you know, for connected aircraft, and, you know, Raytheon is already a major provider for the military aircraft of that today, and whether, you know, Raytheon is developed the next generation digital air traffic control. We're still using an analog system here, radar, you know, ground-based. And so that'll make a safer, you know, air traffic control environment. And then the advanced analytics and AI, Raytheon's really far into that. And that's to optimize both the production, you know, aftermarket service. It's really basic stuff.
They're buying brain power. They're buying engineers. I get all of that. They're going to bring them in, and there's going to be magic. If you're advising the Joint Chiefs of Staff today, what do you say about this transaction?
Well, you can tell from the pitch today that both companies were targeting an audience way beyond institutional investors.
Thank you.
And you only heard like 18 to 20 million of capital return, half dividends, half share buyback in the first 3 years. And that was really the only kind of, if you will, inducement for investors. And what you really heard was, hey, Pentagon, we're going to increase our R&D. We're going to share half the $1 billion of, you know, planned cost savings in the first 3 years. And I think in the other side of the room that really wasn't talked about too much today is Airbus and Boeing. And their approval is critical as well. And, you know, the one key thing here that you don't need approval for is China. And China really held up probably 4 months longer than expected. The Collins transaction, there's no need for China's approval for national defense, you know, suppliers. 30% of these combined sales would be to DOD.
So, Nick, in the marketplace broadly, investors seem to have a preference for, you know, pure play companies. Here we're putting a defense aviation company and a commercial aviation kind of company together. Does that suggest a discount for this pro forma company going forward?
Excellent question, Paul. And I think what's really going on, I asked that last night when I spoke to management, and basically what they're arguing is that the combined companies, even though you'll have 45% commercial, 55% defense, the combined companies will have higher growth. And in turn, that should help offset, if you will, the discount that would normally, you know, be assigned for, you know, a hybrid aerospace.
What do they do with use of cash then? I mean, if you run through yet on a merger basis, I mean, with this dominance almost duopoly, what is it, Paul Sweeney, a triopoly? Nick would call it a quadopoly? I don't know.
Quadopoly.
But
yeah.
Within this focus, no. Nick Heyman, what does use of cash do?
Well, you know, I think that they're looking for $8 billion up from 6 pro forma this year, just for UTC Aero and Raytheon, you're looking at returning 20, you know, billion or something in the first 3 years. So call it, you know, $6-7 billion a year. So, you know, most of your free cash is coming back. Ironically, when you look at the balance sheet of the combined entity, the $26 billion in net debt, only $2 billion of that is Raytheon's. $24 billion is UTC Aero, which is down from $41 billion with, you know, the Otis and the carrier now. To me, it seems like, why do you announce this now? Why today? If this has been in the hopper working through for a year, okay, and my sense is that there's probably something to do with the fact that you wanted to get ahead of the Paris Air Show, because there may be some other news at the Paris Air Show.
Oh, listen to you. He's so good. Nick Heyman, gossip columnist. If you're just joining us, folks, Nick Heyman with us, William Blair. I should point out Paul Sweeney combined. They're on the edge of 300,000 employees.
Yeah, just an extraordinary behemoth here. So what you mentioned, the Paris Air Show, Nick, what do you expect to come out of there? There's a lot of uncertainty. You've got this deal. You've got Boeing. What do you expect to come out of Paris?
Probably no new products, no new platforms. Okay. What we'll see more about is either new orders or we'll see orders possibly, you know, move that aren't yet fulfilled entirely from one supplier to another. So there's going to be more of a shuffle in, you know, the date card than there is necessarily going to be, you know, new announcements about where the next concert's going to be.
Does this deal today, the United Technologies Raytheon deal, does that suggest or does that prompt more M&A in the defense or aviation business?
It's a good question. And, you know, at this juncture, there's less and less on the pure defense that really is going to have, you know, arguably the same kind of strategic merit behind the Raytheon, you know, Technologies Aerospace merger. So you've got General Dynamics, and you've got Northrop Grumman, and you've got Lockheed, and then you start going way down in the weeds in terms of who's there for defense. And then to argue that, you know, they, one of those should merge with GE Aviation or should merge with, you know, Safran or Honeywell.
Well,
Honeywell comes with a lot of other stuff. You know, so I don't really think that this is going to be kind of a domino, you know, first of a series of domino transactions.
Right. But Nick Heyman, one final question. Based on all that you've said here, it really behooves Paul and me to be in Paris in 6 days, 18 hours. I mean, we need to
get the surveillance Gulfstream.
Are you going for the food or the entertainment?
Oh, no, I would never do that. We'd be going for the Guy Johnson lectures on the cast of the wing of an Airbus. Nick Heyman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a great day.
Really appreciate him coming out. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.